Hello. Ah, now that I've got your attention, I'd like a quick word about how Cambridge 105 Radio is funded. Our job is to give a voice to those groups who may not otherwise be heard. That may be our support for local music or the charity of the month. You're wanting to know how you can help, aren't you? Well, you can support our advertisers. And when you use their services, say you heard about them on Cambridge 105 Radio. And you can make a donation. It all goes towards our upkeep. We're eco-friendly, but we do have a bit of an electricity bill. Visit cambridge105.co.uk and click on the donate button. And thank you for listening.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
All right, here we go. Quiet! Problem!
You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it, pull it down.
Mr. Allen, this may come as a shock to you, but there are some men who don't end every sentence with a proposition.
All right, I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
I don't like that music anymore. Mind if I close the window?
Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
Well, here's another nice mess you've gotten me into.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Welcome to Bums on Seats, the show that dares to stare into the abyss of new cinema releases. My name is Toby Miller and joining me in the studio today are regular reviewers Rosie Applin.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
Plus special guest reviewers Karen Ng.
Hello.
And Nahal Kebab Bashi.
Hello.
Today's show is cut only from the finest cloth. We've Daniel Day-Lewis in his final role as the fusspot at the heart of the rich and strange romance of Phantom Thread. 90 years since its stage debut, the brutal World War I drama of Journey's End depicts life in the trenches, and Colin Firth is the around-the-world sailor without of his depth in The Mercy. Plus, we've an interview with Eleanor Lyons from event cinema specialist Star Mouse, and we mark 100 years of the women's suffrage movement by repeating a little of our 2015 feature on Make More Noise, the BFI's compilation of suffragettes depicted in silent cinema. So, another hectic hour is planned, but we begin the film with some notions.
You can sew almost anything into the canvas of a coat. When I was a boy, I started to hide things in the linings of the garments. Things that only I knew were there. Secrets.
Good morning.
Will you have dinner with me?
Yes.
I feel as if I've been looking for you for a very long time. You look beautiful. Very beautiful. I have things I want to do. Things I simply cannot do without you.
Reynolds has made my dreams come true, and I have given him what he desires most in return. Every piece of me. Whatever you do, do it carefully.
All the publicity around Phantom Thread, the new film from American director Paul Thomas Anderson, has focused on its star Daniel Day-Lewis. This is, he tells us, his final performance. But the hype neglects the film itself, which is a strange patchwork of a period drama, a gothic romance, a decadent menu and a family seance, all with a luxurious lining of dark comedy. Day-Lewis stars as Reynolds Woodcock, a dress designer who adorns the high society of 1950s London. One morning, in an English seaside cafe, he encounters Alma, a German waitress played by Vicky Creeps. He tests her memory with an extravagant breakfast order, she passes him a note with her name, and by the afternoon they're walking along the beach, and by the evening, at the end of the day, Alma is a willing model for his designs. Nahal, at first glance, Phantom Thread seems to offer the hoary old cliché of the artist, the older artist, and his younger muse. We've seen it 1,000 times. It's Pygmalion and sort of that. This film, Phantom Thread, doesn't go in that direction at all. It's got much stranger things to say, hasn't it?
I agree. It's a lot to do with, I think, shifts in power and the dynamics of a relationship. So, yes, you have this obsessive, immaculate dominating guy who comes in, and you think that she would just fall at his feet, and then every other woman that comes into his life, they become ghosts, they become phantoms. But then she turns out to be his match, I think. You know, she rises to the challenge, and she's quite manipulating in some senses, and she surprises us at every turn. And there's this scene where she's cooking for him the mushrooms that she's cooking, and you don't really know what's happening between them. You don't know if they understand exactly how this is going to turn out, and that's where really the shift happens. And he's completely disturbed by this new presence in his bachelor life, and he doesn't really know how to deal with that, and that completely transforms, I think, the nature of the relationship, and it's amazing to watch.
Rosie, partly through you have to promote your film around your major star, in this case Day-Lewis, and of course his announcement of retirement has made the publicity drive the film in that direction. This is Vicky Creep's film as much as it's Day-Lewis's, and I would suggest it's Alma's film more than it is Woodcock's film. It gradually, he remains constantly the gravity, the planet on which everybody gravitates around, but we're focusing on her, and she's the one with the arc, she's the one.
Yeah, that's right. And you mentioned earlier that it was sort of subverting the whole kind of the usual style of this sort of story. And actually, you know, normally in this scenario, you would see that she would be the sort of muse and the kind of the canvas that he was painting on. But actually, she's a game changer. She's a disruptor. She comes in and she shifts everything. And it, as you were saying, Nahal, it becomes all about this kind of power game between them and his absolute need for control and perfectionism and this kind of, you know, everything has to be just so and perfect. But she, from the word go, will not accept that. And she does things like crunches toast very noisily.
But then I'm not sure, because she does, but it's not a deliberate, she's not deliberately facing him down from the start. She's making the same mistakes that his previous muses did, in that she's eating breakfast too noisily. She's accidentally rubbing him up the wrong way.
Yeah.
And he's obviously a terribly fussy man and a bully in a traditional Hollywood sense. Mm. It's about halfway through that she finds a different way to assert her power. I don't think she's that strong person.
She
doesn't even find herself until...
But she talks about the staring contest at the very, very beginning of the film.
That's true, yes.
So yeah, she does say that, you know, if you want to engage in a staring contest, I will...
Yeah,
I can't remember
right.
the lines.
You will lose.
Yeah.
You will lose.
I think even the act of giving him her name on a piece of paper after giving her that massive order was already a very bold and powerful thing to do.
And actually, the fact that she not only passed a piece of paper, so this is the very first meeting when he gives her a big, great big breakfast, an impossibly huge breakfast order of muffins and Welsh rarebit for breakfast. The decadence. 1950s Britain as well. This is almost ration here, so it's remarkable. But she not only passes the paper back with her name, but she calls him Hungry Boy, which is... mothering, which becomes increasingly an important statement as the film goes on. And even, this is a film of layers upon layers, and wheels within wheels, as P.G. Woodhouse would say, in that the idea of passing a secretive note links into what Woodcock's doing with his sewing of notes to himself within garments. It's extraordinarily dense in a puzzling, fun way, rather than an obtuse, pretentious way. I don't like the word pretentious, but I'm going to use it here. Karen, did you find... Is it a film that's fair to the women? I've mentioned that it's Alma's film. Cyril, who's played by Leslie Manville, who's Woodcock's sister, is also bullied and put upon, but again, the film sort of shifts. In this current environment, the place we are watching everything now is to see whether it's fair on female characters, whether this is a continuation of the Hollywood cinema's bullying of women. This, at first glance, seems to fall into that trap, and I know certain critics think it does all the way through. But I felt, again, it just shifts. It favours the female characters and points out the genius of Woodcock, but his bullying isn't rewarded as such.
No, and actually, as the film unfolds, you can see that your perspective changes from him being at the center of power and the puppet master to the power. It gradually reveals that his sister has quite a lot of power, and then it very gradually reveals the power of Alma. And actually, by the end of the film, it gradually reveals the power of all the women who are in the in the room sewing, yes, quietly, mm-hmm, silently, but you can see that not only are they being orchestrated by Cyril, if it weren't for them, nothing would happen.
No,
I don't know about fairness.
Is it like a sea of women?
An army of women.
Yeah, an army, yes.
And the film doesn't portray them as servants, even when they are servants. They're bustling at the beginning, at the very opening of the film, all his sewers and all his haberdashery agents, they all troop up these amazing stairs. It's the best film ever made about stairs, other than the 39 steps, obviously. But they're a bit like the mice in a Disney film, and then gradually they have their own agency, just a little bit,
yeah.
and that's outlined by the fact that all the other men in the film just fall away. There's a doctor character, and that's about it.
Mm. I love the head seamstress's response when he collapses.
Oh, gosh.
And she just keeps saying, well, this is going to be a real problem because there are exactly marks now on the dress. And you're just lying on the floor. You know, they've got the doctor in. You know, we're going to have to spend all night doing it. I just love the way she delivered those lines. She's like, well, let's focus on what's really important here. It's the fashion, it's the garment.
Or Leslie Manville, who is quite brilliant in this film, but her response to Woodcock's bullying of her. And she says, just shush, you're hurting my ears. I don't want to hear it anymore.
And she has quite a bit of power over him, I think. In that particular scene, you feel like he knows he stands with her. You know, he can push her buttons to some extent, but at some point she's not taking it.
And he's also completely undone when Alma clears the house, yeah, of all the women, and it's just one man facing one woman, and yeah, he's
goes
down.
Lost.
Yeah, it's like the exactly. It's like the clock has all the parts missing in it now, and he's just there in the face of it alone. One of the things, this is seems to be perfectly designed for me, but the supernatural element, I was in love with that. It reminded me of a Penelope Fitzgerald novel, The Bookshop, which also has a supernatural element that is just introduced as if it's the day. This hasn't the super. It's not quite super.
Vampire.
Well, it's not. It's obviously it's not.
I must say it now.
It's just Daniel Day-Lewis or the character.
Actually, because Leslie Manville orders the steak tartare, so it's probably a family of vampires. I'm convinced.
Yeah. It's certainly a reading. It's not a world where the supernatural exists, but it's a world where characters believe in the supernatural. Yeah. There's an astonishing scene later on where he views his mother, who's died many years previously, in her wedding dress. Like, she's one of those Russian photo where they've colorized the Russian past, and she's just against the wall. And if that's not wonderful enough, then Alma comes in and walks around her. So, I'm too excited. Where they're both in the shots to get shot together.
Yeah, it's a remarkable scene.
But then, and I might be misunderstanding, but there's a tremendous exchange in their first encounter, Alma and Woodcock's first encounter, where he's describing the history of a wedding dress, and it was considered bad luck if a woman just touched the wedding dress that wasn't hers, and how his sister helped him make the wedding dress for their mother. And what happened to his sister? Did she never marry? And he says no. And he doesn't think twice about it, but Alma gets it. Mm. Alma's face says, oh, you've cursed her. You've cursed her by having her make... And apparently there were more scenes with the wedding dress in it that got sort of... that got cut out, and it played a slightly a bigger role in Cyril's. Mm. A lot was... Sorry, that was mostly me, wasn't it? Sorry.
No, but death is very present in the house, isn't there? I mean, even Alma comments on that. And so it's almost as if Woodcock just wants somebody to fill his mom's role. And in the end, actually, so what Alma does is the only time he's vulnerable is when he's ill. And Alma comes to that conclusion. So she poisons him so that by the end she would be the mother figure that takes care of him. But then, you know, my partner pointed out, but the mother figure would never do that. You know, you would not actually poison your child so that you would be able to take care of them.
Is that a step too far then? Because obviously that's where some audience members, when it becomes this strange, I mean, everything's done with love, but it's a peculiar movie-like love or novel-like love, actually, that you don't often see in the movies, and I think that throws people.
It's
they're
a dangerous
expecting
love.
It's a dangerous. What is it? They find a balance.
Well, I think. I think the first time I hope this isn't. Is it okay to spoil a bit?
Let's not give away the complete ending.
Well, I think there's two things that happen. And the first time, perhaps, you don't know if he's aware of the control she's trying to exert on him.
No, he isn't at all.
He isn't.
No.
But the second time, there's definitely the sense that he knows what's going on. And I think that's one of the most interesting moments in the whole film, is
He tweaks. There's a moment where his eyes...
There's a moment where he knows what's happening.
There's consent.
There's consent, and he agrees to it. And he
actually challenges her with his knowledge of it, the way he looks at her.
Yeah.
And it's that incredible moment where they're both aware, yes, we both know what's going on here, and then he allows it, and you just think, wow, that is a fascinating conclusion.
It was a very tense moment. It was amazing.
Yeah. And it's the only two... It's the second time in the film they meet as characters, their love meets. Is that every scene is astounding in this film for me anyway. At the wedding, at the dame's wedding, Dame Barbara, this socialite that he's made a wedding dress for, and she gets drunk and passes out because it's not a happy wedding, and Alma's saying no, she doesn't get to do that in your dress.
That's the first time they really click.
Yeah, I know. It's the first time they sleep together as well after that.
Yeah.
But the whole scene. Did anybody find the film as funny as I did? I thought it was quietly hilarious all the way through. Deliberately so.
There were very funny moments. So for me, some of the funniest moments were the increasing irritation he found about the noise she made when she's eating. Mm. Because if you have misophonia, which is the hatred of the sound of other people eating, you can really sympathise. but I loved the way she was challenging him all the time. I thought it was really funny.
And there was a class thing there, wasn't there?
There's more than that, because the film hints. It doesn't, in fact, this is another question to ask, but did they give Alma enough background? Because it was all cut out. And you get a hint from the way it's cut that she is possibly a German Jew that's fled, and maybe where the rest, she doesn't have a family anymore. Has she lost? Did she lose them in the war? So is that better hinted at than suggested explicitly? I found that
Slightly hinted at, only in that scene again with the wedding of Barbara, where the husband, who's
royalty,
were you selling visas to Jews?
And it cuts to her,
and then she just looks uncomfortable, and you get the feeling, and they never talk about her background, so she probably was orphaned,
and she's an immigrant, and I
feel like maybe his mum was also an immigrant. I don't know if that's the case.
I think because you get the
maybe that's why he also shows this disdain for the upper class, maybe, because he is also coming for, they're both kind of outsiders.
But it's also why, which is something that never mind, Toby. It's something we still fail to realise, how immigration and immigrants embrace other cultures, not just to fit in, but to give themselves a footing. And both of them do these extraordinarily what we'd see as British things, but you can see them as being adopted. You're quite right. I think Woodcock's also a second generation immigrant, and
I actually saw that during the ghost scene that you were talking about, the mother looks impossibly tiny.
Yes.
And she looks Eastern European. Yes. She looks almost like a tiny girl from Eastern Europe, and her dress was really old fashioned.
It's vaguely Slavic, isn't it?
Yes, So that seemed like the biggest hint to me that he was from somewhere else.
And which also explains why maybe they, even though they don't look like they belong together, but they're somehow sewn together by these different backgrounds, perhaps.
Yeah.
It doesn't, as a period film, it doesn't really... this is the first film he shot himself, his normal cinematographer. This is Paul Thomas Anderson, the normal film. His normal cinematographer was elsewhere. So he's the cinematographer on this film. He worked, he shares the credit. He says he shares the credit with his cameraman. But it captures Britain at that time we don't normally see, which is the mid-1950s, where lighting is moving over to luminescent light and everything is becoming slightly tawdry. The glamour of the post-war years is beginning to fade into what would be the rebellion of the 1960s, where Woodcock will struggle entirely. If he can't cope with French design, he'll struggle with the 60s. It's never a period film that leans into its period. It's never beautiful in the way that you would expect it. It's always sort of, again, half-remembered and smoky and slightly seedy, I think.
Which is, I guess, to go with the gothic feel of it too, isn't it? I don't know.
It does, and then within the forest scenes, those are like fairy tale scenes.
Yeah. It felt like the house was slightly out of time, and it was a world all unto itself. And the house in the countryside as well, where they first meet, it all feels like its own immersive world, and it's set apart from the entire world that it happens to be in. It's almost like a spaceship landed in the middle of 50s London, and it was so self-contained, with the stairs and the breakfasts. And,
yeah, it's true. It didn't have the kind of signifiers that you expect in the 50s. It was like that. It was like something it was like they were all trapped in the past.
Yeah. It was, those having grown up in a house that fancy, but grown up in a house that was four floors tall, the creaking floors, everything creaks in this house. At first you think it's just accidental, but it's part of the film's sound design. It's like the toast. Mm. You can imagine how annoyed he would have been with that crumbling, rickety old house when they'd moved in.
The sounds were wonderful. The sounds of the fabric. Yeah. I would get distracted from the story because I was so busy listening to the sounds of people touching fabric.
No, yeah, definitely. The sound of a needle pulling thread through fabric. Yes. It's such a satisfying noise, isn't mm-hmm. it?
The promotion for the film focuses on the fashion element, but I think it's more of a food film than it is a fashion film. And it's
food and hunger are massive themes. Yes. Of the film,
appetite. Yeah.
And it's interesting because he's so hungry and he has this massive appetite, but then as soon as the appetite is fed, he fears that he's losing control, and it's like the only way he can stay in control is if he's constantly hungry.
It's like, that's why he's a vampire.
Oh, back to the theory, exactly.
Honestly.
Case closed.
I don't know if I had another question which has gone out of my head, but the final word, I suppose, is on Johnny Greenwood's music, which is, he's worked with Johnny Greenwood for his last three films. This is the one which it's far less atonal and far more classical than his previous scores. It's almost a character in itself, as I've read. It's in some cases, it's in the background. In other scenes, it's as loud as the characters are, as if they've left... Sometimes it sounds deliberately. This is all on purpose. It sounds like they've left a radio on in the background. And was it the right idea to have such a small film? As we said, it's within two houses, really, and a fantastic scene in a sports car. But the score is huge. The score could be for Marnie. It could be for a Douglas Sirk film. Is that the right decision, do you think, to have this great swoon of a score?
I mean, I sort of thought it was interesting because I was, it's quite melodramatic, I thought, the whole soundtrack. And it is, as you say, very swoony and sumptuous and quite over the top. And it sort of fitted, I think, with the kind of intense drama that was playing out between them, even though what was on the surface was all very ordered.
So we're listening to the inside of their heads, really. We're listening to either Alma or to Woodcock. Yeah. I remember my last point. Again, I suspect that some hot takes or some serious critical views would frown upon this, but I love the way that, because it's not depicted very much in cinema, in the way that he understood, and it's in its almost first bit of voiceover, how he understood how these female characters, not all women, but the female characters that he took on, what made them beautiful. And he gave them confidence. You don't often, the Jocelyn Moorhouse film, The Dressmaker, does that as well, in that she says she doesn't have any confidence, she can't find herself, and he made her beautiful. And it seems cruel. She says, I don't have a bosom. And he says, you're perfect. It's my choice to give you breasts if I choose to. That all sounds cruel and cutting. And I don't think it's meant as such. I think those are really lovely, caring scenes where the scene where he dresses Barbara, who's an older woman, again, seems very affectionate and caring in a way that's unusual for a film.
It seemed like those women definitely went to him to... I thought the film... To address the earlier question about being fair to women, I think that the film did a really good job of showing lots of women's concerns from many, many different angles, whether you're in the sewing room or you're the moneyed woman who's aging and has insecurities, or you're a young woman who has insecurities about her body. They all sort of come to him to have that addressed. Mm-hmm. And I thought the film did a very good job of showing, especially with the rich women, who they seem to have everything, but actually there's still this hole that can't be filled. Mm. And they
were
come
very
to
insecure,
him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's unusual, again, in this day and age, and unfashionable to show the role that fashion and clothes do play in giving somebody confidence, because it's seen as superfluous now or superficial, and I don't think that's the case. And I think, again, the film leans into that, which makes it all the more unusual for this, mm-hmm. for this day and age. Anyway, I think we'll wrap it up. Anybody want to say anything else?
Well, I've got a slightly contrary view to what you just said, which is that I think you could also argue, while it was very kind and what he was doing for them was a service, it was also another form of control.
It is, though I'm not sure how deliberately he means it.
Not necessarily consciously, but if you're looking at his character as a whole, that's another form of power that he has, is the fact that he's able to make a woman feel good about how she looks and how.
But I think he takes pride in it, and he doesn't ask for a reward. He's not even aware of the money that they get. Mm-hmm. He tries to turn one big client, and Cyril, his sister, says she pays for this house.
But he also is doing it for his mother. Underlying all of it, it's a service to his mother, and he's trying to heal something in himself as well.
Yeah, I think it's all about him at the very end of the day. Mm-hmm. Actually, he's quite self.
Oh, he's terrible. He's a monster in many respects.
I agree.
But he's met by an equal, though different, monster.
I mean,
what she does is beyond the pale.
It's definitely bad.
It's not recommended.
I think we could go on for another hour about just that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I've found it terribly romantic, which says more about me. I don't like mushrooms, so I'm okay. Okay. Well, the Phantom Thread opened last week and is still showing at the Arts Picture House. This is Certificate 15. I could have it for breakfast, lunch and dinner. It's the best film I've seen in years. The last 5 or so years have seen an increase in Cambridge cinema outside the cinema, with creative film screenings popping up in Woodlands, Barnes, university halls and on hotel rooftops. But by far, some of the most romantic and elaborate of these event screenings have been courtesy of Star and Mouse, a new company set up in 2017 by Eleanor Lyons and Christian Jauj. Cambridge 105 volunteer and a very fine friend to this show, Teresa Featenby, sat down with Eleanor Lyons to get a lowdown on Star and Mouse. Eleanor discussed why she's fond of the theatrical when it comes to representing film, plus what they're showing this year, what their plans may be for the future. But to begin with, Eleanor explained what the name and where the name Star and Mouse had sprung from.
Star and Mouse Picture Show is a boutique cinema, a trinket cinema that is owned by myself and my partner, Christian. We got the name, it was Christian who made the name up. We were looking for something that embodied both something really small and something big and something magical. And then, of course, with it being an outdoor cinema, it had to link in with it being outside. And actually, the other day I was thinking about the name and thinking that we're beginning to own Star and Mouse more and more. And I was looking at all of my crew running around and making everything look beautiful and making one of our events happen. And really, I thought that the mice are us. We are the mouse, and the star is the... It's whoever we are screening, whether it be Julia Roberts or Tom Cruise or Tom Hardy or any film star. But then it also linked back to actually the real stars are my crew.
There's a couple of other pop-up cinema shows popping up. Excuse the pun. How do your screenings differ from them?
I think that there's room for everybody for a start. So we are not the first cinema in Cambridge that is doing a kind of pop-up event, as you call it. But I guess we're a pop-up with a twist. So our tickets are anywhere between £12 and £15. What you get for your money just depends on how expensive your ticket is. So our boutique tickets, we have hot water bottles available. We have our lovely seating. Ordinarily, if you go to an outdoor film, you'll have to take your old camping chairs yourself. We have musicians, we have some live entertaining, and then we really look at kind of making a world for people to step into. So you obviously came to Narnia, and when we did Narnia, we dropped it into a pine wood. We dropped a pine wood into a barn. We went and collected leaves, so we had a forest in an indoor forest.
Impossible. Don't worry. I'm sure it's just your imagination.
And really, it's just kind of, we hope to create a little bit of magic. For us, it's not just a film.
So once upon a time, a trip to the cinema was an event. is your aim to put a little more pizzazz back into A Night at the Movies?
Yeah, for me it's a really indulgent thing to do, and I think that people are so easily entertained from home by the flick of a button, and really what I'm hoping to do with Star and Mouse is draw people out and go and support other businesses as well. You know, we're making ties with Maddingley Hall, we're making ties with Manor Barn, we're making tools with the American Cemetery. I really hope with the cinema that we're providing is that people get to go somewhere new, and they get to go in and see a new part of Cambridge or the town that they're from, because we're not just in Cambridge anymore, and they get to find out something new.
So what screenings do you have lined up for this, like, winter and spring?
So next up we have The Artist, which is our kind of Valentine's special. Great film. And we're really lucky because we've got a lovely pianist. She's a classically trained pianist who's coming to play our Steinway piano at Maddingley Hall.
Can I take my own food and my own deck chair?
No, you cannot. You can bring your own deck chair if you're that attached to it. You need to not leave it at home. But no, we don't allow picnics to come. We are running a cinema. We have to pay 40% of our box office takings for royalties of the film. So we have to also pay for our staff and for a venue hire. And a nice way of us being able to cover costs of the event that we do is providing food. And if we're providing food and then people don't eat it, then we're also wasting food. So we do ask people not to bring picnics. They can bring friends, and they can bring blankets, and they can bring dogs. Then we're doing Embrace, the documentary, which is just such an incredible project to be part of. It's about positive body image for women. And then there's a whole host of stuff coming up in the summer. We've got, I've just released some dates for May, so Bank Holiday May. We have a fairy tale and fantasy weekend. So everything from Labyrinth to Stardust to Lord of the Rings, with How to Train Your Dragon. There's lots going on.
How have previous screenings gone, and have you learned anything from them?
Oh, yeah, we've learned so much. It was a real joy doing last year, which was our first year as Star and Mouse. We had moments of feeling like we were never going to get builds done on time. We have a very, very good team of people who come and rescue us. We really owe everything to two people, Phil and Paul, who we are very blessed to have on our team.
So how could I keep up to date with all the screenings? Is there a newsletter or a website? Or...
I am, just as we speak, putting everything up onto our website and onto our Facebook page. We're quite active with both of those things. So, yes, that's how you can reach us.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many thanks to Eleanor Lyons for the interview and for Teresa for proposing, planning and handling the interview. Fantastic. Lots of information on Star and Mouse, including details for their 2018 events, may be found on their website, which is www.starandmouse.com. And they also may be found on Twitter and Facebook. Again, just search for Star and Mouse, but capitalise the mouse, so Star and Mouse.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
A
Hello, it's Greg here. I'd like to tell you about the Kid for the Cat show, where we play original 78 RPM gramophone records every other Tuesday night between 9 and 11 o'clock at night. And usually have one or two guests in with us as well. So come and join Kipper and me and enjoy the old music here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Still to come on today's show, we've a little bit on the BFI's Make More Noise, plus a swift review of The Mercy. But first, we find ourselves at the front.
Second Lieutenant Raleigh, sir.
What is it you're after?
An old friend is out here, Captain Stannard.
You don't want to join them. They may have a hell of a time of it.
That's just what I'm hoping for, sir.
You haven't been in the army 5 minutes, have you?
Company commander, you know?
Hello, Stannard.
You'll find him changed. He's led this company through all sorts of rotten times. Big strain on the man.
He used to come and stay with me and my sister Margaret in the holidays.
She is beautiful. Is she waiting for you?
I don't want her to see how shot I am. We won't last 5 minutes if the Germans attack.
You'll just stay where you are for as long as you can.
When's it expected?
Day after tomorrow.
While we've had recently a fair few new films mythologizing the events of World War II, the aggressively purposeless slaughter of the First World War is less easily turned into patriotism, something underlined by new release Journey's End. Based on the 1928 play by R.C. Sheridan and adapted from his own experiences on the front, Journey's End is set in a small section of the trenches on the British front line in northern France. Here are sequestered the ragtag remnants of an infantry unit headed by Captain Stanhope, played by Sam Coughlin. The advancing German army are only a muddy field away, and Stanhope's exhausted soldiers are instructed to hold the line when the expected final assault arrives. Rosie Soldip, who directed Journey's End, he said he was after trying to make... he wanted a film that was sort of anti-macho, because obviously even a film like Dunkirk, which is an honest and sincere portrayal of war, still can't help but build up that sort of the ferocity of heroism. This film doesn't do... He doesn't want that film, this film, to do that. Has he succeeded?
That's really interesting. I hadn't heard that, and that's something I really took from it, actually. It's that, you know, often with these kind of films, you do get this sort of the stiff upper lip, the kind of the absolute heroism, and, you know, there is occasionally the kind of glorification of war. And I thought what really came over in this was the authenticity of responses. It just felt so real, the way each of the characters behaved and the way that they dealt with what was going on. And I think particularly some of the moments that really affected me were when, you know, these men broke down in front of each other and revealed their vulnerability and their fear. And, you know, there's a moment where two of them just hug, and it's just so real and so moving. And I kind of, one of the notes I made was that it's actually, there are just tiny moments of heroism, but they're just as real as, you know, some of the big kind of overblown movie moments you get in some other kind of big Hollywood films. It was just very small things that they would do for each other, you know, helping them to maybe be a bit in denial about what's going on, because that's really the only thing they can choose to do. And yeah, just some incredible performances. I thought Sam Coughlin was absolutely incredible. Was incredible. He's just got such an expressive range, this face, like the way that he kind of portrayed one moment trying to hold it all together, the next just being absolutely broken and like a sort of almost like a little boy. It was just, yeah, he was a very compelling performance, I thought.
Dave, bringing you finally into the show after missing out on Phantom Thread. It's it's based on a stage play, but it's also partly based on the book, Sheriff's book, that followed after the stage play. Is it successful as a piece of cinema? Because it moves the action out of just the officers' quarters, which his play is dominated by, and into the trenches. Does that sort of open it out a little bit, or make it? Is it still claustrophobic?
It's very funny. I knew it was based on a play, so I was expecting something. I wondered if it would translate. And what impressed me most was the way, as you mentioned, the claustrophobia did come across when they moved outside. So in the trenches, the walls are always oppressing, you know, people are squeezing by each other to get past, you know, you've got to make sure you duck down or you'll be a target for someone who's just a few yards away trying to kill you. And there was always this oppressive atmosphere in everything they do, even before they make one foolhardy raid over the top. The idea of even just standing up seems like you can't stand up. There's something already over there. It's just always pushing down on you. And I thought, for taking, as you said, a one-room play and managing to bring that sense across throughout the entire film, even on the wider shots when they're behind the lines, so characters are called back to report to the higher-ups, or in the case of Asa Butterfield's character, Lieutenant Raleigh, he's journeying in. And even then, you know, the atmosphere is just enough that there's bits wrong. It doesn't feel natural. It feels like, you know, we're away from this thing, but there is something terrible lurking just out of shot, just out of reach from our eyes, and this is the horror that these men are all having to face.
Is it did the ticking bomb, again to use a director's phrase, of this German attack that they know because they've captured a German and he's talked, there's a big German attack in 2 days, does that not an artificiality but that conventional structure hinder the film? Because I thought it would have been, I liked it, but I wish it wasn't hung up so much on this doom. I wish it was the repetitive nature of the Sisyphean task of fighting in a pointless war in pointless situations, doing decisions that don't make any sense. I thought that sort of, oh, but we know this is coming up, made it a little bit too structured.
Yeah, the sort of sense of an inevitability.
There was an escape. It was a horrible escape, but it was still an escape. Would it have been a bit amount, or am I looking for something that's probably a bit too experimental, maybe?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose there were things that happened that I didn't know were going to happen. You know, it wasn't completely predictable. But I think really what was, as Dave mentioned about the claustrophobia, that was, you know, that helped to build the tension. You knew this was going to happen, and it was really all about the journey that the different characters took in how they dealt with that. And so I think that was actually the driving force behind the film, in a way, was that inevitability, and it's just what happens to people in the situation.
It was the sound and the music that was getting to me a lot during the film. So at the start of every day you do hear, I don't know if you could pick it up, a tiny hint of a pocket watch. And it is actually a ticking time bomb going off, signalling something is coming, something's on the way. But also the soundtrack wavers between these lovely little kind of lyrical piano pieces and then this heavy overture that's just coming in. And it's the mix between the two. You can see why, you know, they're doing their best to try and make the audience feel as crazy as some of the people in the trench were going. You know, it's just an impossible decision. And you know, you mentioned that, is there some kind of way out? It's like, yes, but it's not the way out that people actually want, is it?
Well, it's the way out they want by the time they finish the film. They yeah, all accept that death is coming, and they're not happy about that, but it's better than the alternative, which is more and more of this. I think I just felt it should have stressed more and more of this. There should have been a sort of Cagean view of the repetitive nature. But I think I can't criticize for a film for not doing what I wanted it to do. That's facile. A final word, it's a great cast. It is a good cast, as you mentioned, Rosie, Toby Jones, Asa Butterfield. It's very good in a role that doesn't quite develop the way I thought it was going to. That's not a criticism. Paul Bettany. It's nice to see Paul Bettany having to act again. Not that he doesn't act in other things, but this is a good showcase for him, I felt, is the kindly schoolteachery sort of Osborne.
He pretty much broke my heart.
Yeah, I just felt absolutely heartbroken. There's a scene, actually, again, about the claustrophobia thing, where he, for a moment, just goes up and stands in the sunlight. And that's like one of the rare moments in the whole film where you feel like, oh, I can take a breath, the tension's over, but it's momentary. And just his facial expression in that scene is heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking is the word, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, well, okay, well, thank you very much. Journey's End opened last Friday and is still showing, has some screenings at the Arts Picture House. It's well worth seeing. It is a Certificate 12A. This past week was the anniversary of 100 years since the suffrage movement won women the right to vote. To mark the occasion, it seemed a good idea to repeat a little bit of our 2015 feature on the BFI's Make More Noise release. It was specially curated to accompany the release of Suffragette in 2015. Make More Noise, it's a compilation of 21 short films, newsreels and documentaries alongside early comedies, and it throws light on how popular entertainment of early cinema depicted the suffragette movement. At the time, the compilation was touring cinemas, but now it's easily available to buy on DVD. So, back in 2015, I spoke to Bryony Dixon of the BFI about this release, and I began by asking her how the suffragettes used newsreels and newsreel crews to spread their message.
It's fairly indirect, the way that the suffragettes use film. They don't, as you would expect to do now, you would actually sort of go and make your own films or, you know, do sort of campaigns through different sorts of media. In those days, the best you could hope to do, really, was just sort of get in front of the camera. What they do, as soon as newsreel cameras are about, they make sure that they give the cameramen best positions. So say you're holding a big rally, as they did at Trafalgar Square. What you would do is to say, surely you can't get a good shot from there of what's going on. Why don't you come and stand up here with us on this platform, and then you'll get a really good view. And by doing that kind of thing, it made sure that they were constantly seen, and it made sure that the newsreel cameramen were not hostile. So all of the newsreel footage is kind of neutral in tone about the suffragette, although they use the word suffragette, and occasionally they talk about violence and outrages. Generally speaking, it's much more neutral than the rest of the media is.
I think that's what surprised me, because I expected the tone to be a little bit, because you imagine, just like today, Pathé or these big media companies would be owned by men, so the tone would be hostile. But that was a clever way of getting around that.
There is another very important thing to remember, because of the sort of telescopic kind of way that we learn history, that the important thing to know about the suffragette campaign is that it was not a battle of the sexes. All that comes into it, of course, and is at the sort of heart of it. Really, it's amazing how many men support votes for women. So you get films like Mass Meeting of Suffragette. You see them holding up this banner saying, 3,000 men in Scunthorpe support votes for women. And there are, there's a banner from every town in the land on display there. So it's not really a battle of the sexes. It's a battle for power. And we have to also remember that 40% of the male population couldn't vote either.
Could you explain a little bit about the mix of films that make more noise? At first glance, and judging from what we've just been talking about, you would think it would all be newsreel, but the collection has been carefully curated, so it shows how popular cinema reflected the mood of the public watching.
Exactly so. The footage of suffragettes, the demonstrations and people giving speeches and stuff is fairly well known, but we also wanted to show how women were represented and how they sort of saw themselves. The cinema-going population by the time the war breaks out is 20 million people, and most or a lot of those are women and children. So that's one thing to remember. And the other thing is that only, I think, less than 8 million people could vote. So it's a different part of society that's looking at itself. So you get these fantastic comedies where young girls in particular behaving appallingly. They just do whatever the hell they like. There's a sort of expectation that they're going to behave like lovely, Edwardian young ladies and be very demure. But this is not the case at all. They want to go out on roller skates and bicycles and chat up boys and generally behave like young people. And they do in these films, and it's marvellous to watch. And then, when they grow up, they get married to, rich men for their money, and then leave them at home with the babies and go off and play golf. How good is that?
I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about the Tilly Girl films, which you've got two or three in the collection. They're such a weirdly modern mix of slapstick and silliness. It's a silliness that I love.
Well, the origin of the Tilly Girls films is really with the chase comedy, which is a thing that develops in the 1900s. So it's the earliest kind of comedy. Once you get away from the single shot sketch, you get these fantastic chasings. So normally what you have is a mischievous boy will do something. He'll nick something or cause some sort of mayhem, and then everybody will chase after him, you know, like the sort of goose that laid the golden egg kind of thing. Then they make a refinement. Of course, you know, with films, you've always got to top the topper, as they call it. So they then had two naughty boys in these films, and sort of duos. And then they think, well, what can we do next that's novel? Ah, girls. So that's how that arises. And what happens is, you know, the two girls decide to sort of run off and run away from home for the afternoon and do something outrageous, like steal a fire engine and take it for a joyride. And, you know, all the people chasing after them. And then it usually ends up with them winning. So it's a very positive, joyful message. And I don't know anyone who's seen one who doesn't just love them.
They must have been hugely influential at the time, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think they probably were. I mean, there were, I don't know, something like 20 or so of them made over the years, a very short period of time, between about 1910 and 1912. So it's short-lived, but yeah, I think they probably were quite popular.
Change tone, you include all of the 1917 documentary A Day in the Life of a Munitions Worker, which I found the most fascinating film in the collection. There's almost a Humphrey Jennings style depth in the image of this newfound freedom of the workplace. It's factory work, but it's very well paid factory work, and there's an independence in that, but this is being granted by building bombs.
Yes, it's a beautifully crafted film, and it's an official film. It's made by the Ministry of Information, which is quite new. It's really only just been set up, and the government has taken a little time to kind of get used to the idea of using film and the cinema to promote its messages. It's generally kind of soft propaganda. So this is partly saying that this is an acceptable thing to do, and it's partly kind of thanking women who are working in these factories, and it's also partly there to recruit. But yeah, the message is basically, yeah, these young girls, and they are all very young, can run this factory, and they can be left in charge of these very responsible jobs on their own, supplying shells to the front, which is essential.
And it shows, and this might have been an area that I kind of wish a feature film would deal with, in that it's how war, and it happened again with the Second World War, normalizes revolution in other areas.
Absolutely. And you know, the vote when it finally came in 1918, you know, this was not, you know, the politicians going, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if women had the vote? You know, this was the end of a long, long period of struggle. And as you say, these normalizing of these sort of making people aware that women worked.
Do you think cinema was doing more than reporting change, or was it helping to affect a change? I'm thinking because you have two films a few years apart, one of which, Milling the Militants, has wearing trousers as a punishment, and one of the Tilly Girl films that you have later on has them end with them walking away in trousers, as you say, to play golf. So do you think this was having an effect on the audience that was watching it, as you say, the majority of which were women?
So if you've got 20 million people a week watching these films, they will have an effect, even if they're comedy. Comedy is this kind of test bed for doing, you know, pushing the boundaries and seeing what you can get away with. And, you know, if you can imagine it, then you can think about, ooh, actually, why can't we do these things? So it's a very useful expression of how people are thinking. And because they occur fairly frequently, we can imagine that there are, you know, women who are thinking, well, why can't I go out to work and earn my own money and, you know, not just sort of get married and suffer and be treated badly. So comedy is a very useful social barometer.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And the excellent Make More Noise collection is now easy and cheap. It's about £7, £7, £8 to purchase on DVD from all the usual outlets. And this is a good opportunity to make quick mention of this month's Real Women event, screening at the Arts Picture House. This evening of short films, which happens every month, short films from female filmmakers, takes place this month at 9 p.m. this coming Thursday, 15th of February. This month's theme is documentary. It's free to attend, but do make sure to get to the bar as early as possible because it's very popular and it fills up quite quickly. So that's this month's Real Women event. We end our show on the high seas. Based on a true story, The Mercy is the cautionary tale of Donald Crowhurst, who in 1969 took part in the first around-the-world yacht race. Colin Firth stars as Crowhurst, a small-time inventor who signs up for the race in an act of ridiculous confidence and hubris. Really, he's only a weekend sailor, and Crowhurst has to raise the money for his venture at the cost of his family home, and he leaves his wife, played by Rachel Weisz, with promises that he'll return triumphant and all their problems will be solved. But after only a few days at sea, Crowhurst's bravado begins to turn to panic and bluster.
A great deal of pressure falls on the man, alone on a boat. The sea shows no mercy.
Where are the leaders?
3,000 miles ahead.
If I go on, my chances of survival would be 50-50. If I turn back, I face certain ruin. I can't go on, and I can't go home. So where else is there? I'm here. What if I tell them I'm... Yeah.
This week, Donald Crowhurst has been posting some remarkable speeds.
What do I do now?
A new single-handed record!
I'm out here alone!
I thought I could play the game better. Life must be lived. So the question becomes, what can you do to give it all meaning?
Dave, The Mercy's director, James Marsh, he's had an interesting career. Documentaries, he's directed Man on Wire and Project Nim, and dramas. He directed Theory of Everything, but he also directed Shadow Dancer, which is very good. Is this a film that you think would be better as a documentary? Do you think he's found a sort of way of making it a narrative film?
It did feel kind of documentary in style at times. I wondered about it. There's a particular use. He likes to introduce cuts and flashbacks throughout, and it felt like he'd made a documentary and then recut it into a narrative film at times, which did always work for me. Yeah, to some extent, it's very good at showing the slow descent into, or at times the rapid descent into madness.
Very rapid, yes.
That Crowhurst goes through. We were talking about the impossible situations people found themselves in Journey's End. He's another person who's just gone and.
But
he's voluntarily
gone into a.
Might say the same thing about the people in World War One, and it's he seems to embrace the madness a little bit more. I think embrace is the wrong word, but I can't think of a better way of saying it. It's kind of a horrific study of this descent into craziness. There's always a way out, and he just always seems to veer away from
it. I'm not sure there is always a way out. I think he, but then the film sort of paints him into slightly more of a corner than perhaps real life did. Karen, this is no great piece of interesting art, but I was kind of fascinated that it was another film that knowingly undercut the male pride. He's a typical movie character. Obviously, this is real life, but in a normal film, he would achieve what he's gone out to do. And I like the fact that he's the white, middle-class Englishman who's only ever known empire and boys' own adventures, who finds real life horrible. And I felt that was undercut, but does it sort of deliver on that theme, do you think?
Well, I actually went into the story completely cold. I had no idea who this person was or what the story was. So I actually went in expecting a Hollywood ending that he would triumph over.
Oh, crikey.
He would triumph over nature. And I was wrong. So I guess everybody knows how this ends. I felt like, actually, it didn't seem like a documentary to me. It felt like a made-for-TV movie, and it felt like everything was kind of glossed over. It felt like his hubris was kind of glossed over. He does say a couple of philosophical things, and from that we're supposed to get that he's very idealistic, and that gives him, he thinks that he has what it takes to do this. But I just didn't feel like there was a sense of investment, and they didn't sort of take time to delve into his character and why he would want to do that, and it didn't really take the time to delve into his wife's character, and she just seemed to sort of passively agree with everything. Yeah, just sort of
which would have been more in keeping with the time. I think I think there's a little bit. You get a little bit of what drives him in the way that he treats his own two sons, especially, but also his daughter. He's not a bad father by at all, but he in the one scenes we have of them spouting on a lake before he's made this decision to go in this around the world race, he's feeding them the same, not lies, because obviously you have to give children dreams, but he's giving them dreams at the expense of everything else. And you can imagine he's been brought up even more so because the empire would have been in place and Britain ruled the oceans. And I think you get a little bit of that's what drives him. But does the film chicken out, do you think, Dave? Because, again, it starts to throw the blame more on the press, his press agent, played by David Thewlis.
Yeah.
And there's a scene near the end where Rachel Weisz stands up at her doorway after her husband's been lost and says, "You're to blame, the press." And I thought, well, that might be the case, but you haven't stressed that in this film.
Yeah, it's almost like they may have had an agenda to drive the idea of the press being the villain or something like that, but it got lost. I wonder if there's a much longer film somewhere and they've cut it down for, because it's only an hour 40 minutes long. I wonder if there might be a 2.5 hour epic out there where it properly explores.
I don't want
the
that. I agree with Karen that there's lots of bits missing, but I quite like the fact it was like a little paperback novel you'd find somewhere, and it just told the story and didn't make it into an epic, didn't make it into a Hemingway book. It was it's a tawdry little mistake.
It felt like there was no emotional depth at all. Even the rapid descent into madness.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody else probably going into this film knows what's happening to him. The descent into madness was also just seemed like a glossed over sort of cartoony thing that just suddenly happens and then all of a sudden it's over.
Yeah. There was one scene where he actually seems, after he's gone, quite bonkers. He seems remarkably sane. And then it's horribly undercut when you realise he's been talking to all these people on a phone that isn't actually connected to anything. It was like, well, all semblance of sanity is going out the window.
So the film's not quite ready to
lean
into the madness. It constantly cuts back to his wife, and that's good because it gives Rachel Weisz more to do than just cry over the phone. But which makes a nice change. And the film, it tries to balance all the characters, but again, he doesn't deserve the comeuppance he gets.
David Thewlis' character was continually coming across as a villain. I don't know if he was written that way, but every scene he was in, I always thought, you're a bit shady and shifty. Even at the end, after everything has happened, he's the person who goes and recovers the logbooks because after the boat's recovered.
Yes.
And then he turns it around to make it another news story. And it's like, you're just being portrayed as a horrible human being.
Daily Mail was slightly a different paper in the late 60s, slightly. But he was ex-Daily Mail and he was he brought on his press public relations. So I don't know, it felt like they were passing the buck slightly. And it was much more interesting when it was a dissolution. Maybe it was much more interesting, Toby, but perhaps untruthful. But the idea of somebody thinking they could continue, the male hubris failing, I thought was so unusual for a film in this day and age.
Colin Firth, who doesn't fail.
I know. Anyway, all right, well, I don't know. I found it an interesting film, but then I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
I can't believe you went in. I love the fact you went in. I hope he's going to arrive. Okay, well, all right. The Mercy opened yesterday. Oh, it's worth mentioning there's another film about this coming out this year, and there's been about six films. So it's a popular story. The Mercy opened yesterday, February the 9th, and is now showing at both the Arts Picture House and the Light Multiplex, and it is a Certificate 12A. And that is it for this show. The past hour will be repeated tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m, while a podcast will arrive this Monday, and that will be available from both our page on the Cambridge 105 website and via the Bums on Seats page on iTunes. And don't forget, you can find Bums on Seats on both Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Bums on Seats. Like all the best Hollywood villains, we will be back. Join us in a fortnight's time, that's February the 24th, for another show. This time we should be looking at three of the biggest films of the year: Marvel's Black Panther, Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, and Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. Plus, there is a release of savage black comedy I, Tonya, while Mute is the long-awaited new science fiction film from Duncan Jones, who directed Moon and Source Code, and that's due to be released over on Netflix. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.